It appears the U.S. does not need to hide its intentions behind the war in Ukraine. Military sales, for example, are one major incentive for the U.S. The U.S. President Joe Biden has praised Lockheed Martin for making Javelin missiles in a visit to the plant that produces them. The U.S. push behind applauding military manufacturers of keeping up with weapons orders for Ukraine comes as casualties are mounting in Ukraine, economies are unraveling, and the world is edging closer to World War III. Let me first introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us is Arnold August, an author and journalist from Montreal. Also joining us is Daniel Lazar, who's a journalist and author, who joins us from New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both. Arnold August, I'll start with you. The U.S. President Joe Biden on Tuesday visited this Lockheed Martin company. The ticker symbol is LMT.N, just so we can relate that to the topic of our program. It manufactures the anti-tank Javelin missile, and filming that took place there, he was applauding the factory workers and the company for keeping up with the orders there. Now, this is kind of reminiscent of what Trump was doing, if you remember, in that scene in the White House, I forget which room, with Mohammed bin Salman, with the placards saying thank you and the orders and, you know, all that show that he put on there, which made lots of money for the U.S. What does that show to you when you have the U.S. president visiting this plant and applauding the plant workers and the company itself?
Well, I think the first thing is that the United States has apparently put aside any pretense that the war in Ukraine against Russia is for anything like for democracy or whatever. And they cannot even hide the fact that those who are calling the shots are the weapons manufacturers. For example, Austin, Secretary of Defense Austin, at one point joined the main partner of Lockheed, which is Raytheon, who together are producing this very dangerous missile. Now, when one goes on to their website of this company that Biden visited yesterday, they sell these javelins like Americans may say sell ice cream. We have the best ice cream. We have the best hot dogs. It's so cynical. Allow me to share with you and the listeners just a couple of sentences from that company selling their product. The world's premier shoulder-to-shoulder fired anti-armor system Javelin takes the fight to the enemy. Javelin automatically guides itself to the target after launch, allowing the gunner to take cover and avoid counterfire. Soldiers or Marines can reposition themselves immediately after firing or reload to engage another threat. Using an arch top attack profile, Javelin climbs above its target for improved visibility and then strikes where the armor is weakened. I mean, you know, it's a very dangerous weapon. And it could cause a lot of harm to the Russian forces and contribute substantially to increase the conflict and bringing the forces even farther away from any negotiated settlement. In any case, they don't seem to be interested at all in negotiating a negotiated settlement.
No, not at all. And Daniel Lazar, as a matter of fact, it is said that Biden is using this visit to press Congress to approve what he is now proposing, which is just $33 billion for assisting Ukraine militarily, including more than the $20 billion in military aid. So far, $4 billion or more to have been allocated to Ukraine. I mean, when you take a step back at the way that this is coming consecutively in the past, I think, 2 to 3 weeks max, what do you think, Daniel Lazar? What is the U.S. doing here?
Well, there's no doubt that a lot of arms manufacturers are making a lot of money off these weapons. They are having a wonderful time as they rake in the profits and work overtime to turn these weapons out. But there's something interesting going on here, because the U.S. is actually having trouble making up for all the weapons that the Ukrainians are running through on the battlefield. So they apparently are firing these missiles like mad. It's not clear how many, what effect they're having, and reports from the battlefield are actually somewhat mixed concerning their effectiveness. But the U.S. is pulling out all stops. It's revving up its factory lines. It is putting money in the hands of arms makers and urging them to do everything they can to keep these weapons flowing. But it shows that the U.S. Is determined to win this war. It is not at all interested in a negotiated settlement. It wants to win. It wants to drive Russia out of the Ukraine and probably out of the Crimean Peninsula and the Donbass republics as well. So the U.S. is striving for a maximum victory here, and that will essentially wreak an enormous price in terms of economic damage and the loss of human life.
Yeah, maybe we briefly, if you can elaborate a little bit more as to what you think the reasons are when you said, Daniel Lazar, that they're running out of supplies, that they can't keep up with the amounts that need to be, given to Ukraine. Are they running out of supplies based on the fact that what they're providing, which is so much, is not working against Russia, that Russia is putting up a good front? Is that what you mean, Daniel Lazar, or what's really happening?
Yeah, I mean, I think the reviews from the battlefield are actually kind of mixed as to how effective these weapons are, and the Western press, sings the praises of the Ukrainian military, saying that it's winning one battle after the other, but in fact, in the same breath, it points out that the Russians are pressing a 300-mile wide offensive against the Ukrainians, and that takes a lot of firepower. So apparently the Ukrainians are having a good deal of trouble in coping with that offensive. And they're running through munitions like crazy, and the U.S. is doing everything it can to supply them with the weapons they need. But it's clear the war is not going quite as smoothly as the Western media says it is, and that the Russian steamroller is forging ahead.
Arnold August, thank you so much for the information that you gave to us about the way that these Javelin works. Now, when Biden actually came out and said this fight is not going to be cheap, and that they are working hard to become the biggest producer of semiconductor chips that are needed for these Javelin missiles, and many other high technology goods. Now, I'm curious as to whether he's using the fact that the U.S. is running low on semiconductor chips, that war is good, so therefore we need equipment, so therefore we need to produce these chips. Is that what he's saying? I mean, he could maybe use another product. I'm sure it's not just machine guns or Javelin or whatever military equipment that use semiconductor chips.
No, I think that is the implication with regards to Biden's statement. So, of course, this opens up another sector of the American economy in addition to the open arms production, and that is the, you know, Silicon Valley type of activity with these chips. And I think it's a, you know, just to substantiate what was said previously, that another indication that the United States is far from strong and far from actually winning the war is while Biden was making this announcement for increased Javelin production and shipments to Ukraine, you have another important actor, Israel, openly saying yesterday that they are going to increase their military help to the Zelensky government, as well as for arms as and even soldiers. Now, for the United States to get involved openly with Israel in this conflict, that means I think they're dangerous because they are taking a chance. You know, what can, you know, this thing could have effect in the Middle East as well, where Iran has made it very clear that they will not accept Israeli aggression. They will not accept, and also Russia has said that said to Israel, you better stay out of Ukraine. But, you know, this is dangerous for the United States. I think the United States is desperate, so they have to pull that that last ditch effort to try to get Israel involved. And that could also have important repercussions amongst other countries in the West who probably would not like to see Israel involved in Ukraine, because Israel is known as an apartheid state, as a fascist state. So by their participation in this war alongside the Zelensky government, it confirms what the Russians are saying, that it is a, you know, that the Zelensky government is a fascist government that aligns with anyone to oppose Russia. And we should not forget as well the former head of the CIA and the former Secretary of Defense, Panella. He openly said in a TV interview with the liberal CNN that our goal, United American goal, is to kill as many Russians as possible. That's not me saying it. That he is saying it. So this thing is, you know, is bound to accelerate, and it's obvious that United States are not interested in negotiated settlement. They are only interested in weakening Russia and trying to defeat Russia. But I think their goal, they will be very disappointed in the coming weeks and months.
Sure. Well, just to add to what you said, Daniel Lazar, is the fact that the U.S. actually has provided Ukraine with 10 of these anti-tank missiles per each tank. So 10 times the amount to make sure that gets rid of Russian tanks. Now, what's interesting over here when you take a look at just the military aspect of this, Daniel Lazar, is the meeting that was held in Germany just days ago, I believe, where it was by invitation of the U.S., where 40 countries were invited. And basically this was, again, trying to get a pledge from these countries to assist Ukraine militarily. And what's interesting about this is the fact that, correct me if I'm wrong, Daniel Lazar, doesn't the U.S. actually provide most NATO countries with their military equipment? And therefore, it's asking them to either help out or purchase new ones. And before I ask you for your reaction, this is what the Lockheed Raytheon spokesperson, which is this joint venture between the two for the Javelin, said: we are exploring options to more quickly replenish U.S. inventories and backfill depleted stocks of allies and partners. So it kind of points to the fact that the U.S. wins no matter what here.
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. is going to make, the U.S. arms manufacturers are making a lot of money. And the U.S. dominance in terms of weaponry will be more and more established as a consequence of this war. But, you know, I just wouldn't reduce it to a simple question of profits. I mean, what's important is empire. And essentially, Biden can't afford to lose this war. Because if he loses this war, essentially it'll be the Afghan debacle multiplied by 100. The U.S. will be so profoundly shaken that the American empire will be shaken to its core around the world. So the U.S. is in a fight for its life, just as Russia is in a fight for its life. And therefore, Biden is pulling out all stops. He's got everything riding on victory, and he is determined to prevail on the battlefield and in the process to overthrow Putin, to essentially cripple Russia. And then, as Liz Truss just pointed out in London, to establish a kind of a worldwide, you know, global NATO that will humble China as well. So those are the U.S. goals.
Well, I mean, if that is the case, which fingers are pointing to that direction, Arnold August, when was the last time the U.S. actually did win a war? Did it win in Syria? Did it win in Afghanistan? I mean, when was the last time that it did?
Well, the last time was the Second World War, but it was the Soviet Union, ironically, that won it for the United States. Since then, they've lost everything. They lost all the wars, and the situation in Ukraine, their goal now is to weaken Russia, right, as part of the overall attempt to establish a domination against the growing Russia-Chinese alliance. But that goal is not just like since February 24. That goal started several years ago when NATO, under the direction and the leadership of the United States and their close allies such as Canada, provoked Russia, went up to Russia's border. Even the Pope had to admit that yesterday, half-heartedly, that perhaps it was NATO that provoked Russia. So that the goal that they're seeking now, domination, actually was the same goal that provoked NATO's aggressiveness against Russia starting in the coup, the Maidan coup in 2014. So it's a continuation of the same goal, United States. But now what is different now compared to before 2014 is that the multipolar world is stronger. Like, United States can kid themselves by saying, the international community. But what is the international community that is supporting their action against Russia? It's basically Europe and North America. If you look at all of the global south, the vast majority, almost all of the countries, either do not refuse to denounce a Russian invasion or are also against the U.S. policy of sanctions against Russia. So they can kid themselves, but the international community is just themselves. And I think by getting Israel more fully and openly involved in Ukraine, how will that go down with even the Arab countries such as Saudi Arabia and other countries all over the South, the global South, who have no interest, no feeling, favorable feeling with regards to Israel? It'll backfire against them, and they'll even have lose more friends in the world, aside, of course, from the European and North American core.
So, Daniel Lazar, correct me if I'm wrong. If we're sitting looking at Russia and the officials there, in particular Putin, obviously, and the head of the military, and they're getting squeezed left, right, and center, and with the fact now that you have Israel reported to have fighters there on the ground, also the fact that you're having the U.S., which I'm sure, if you agree, has special operatives on the ground in Ukraine. Recent reports saying that it's training people in Germany, Ukrainians in Germany. We're looking at Russia, that's a nuclear-powered nation that has more nuclear bombs than the U.S. Isn't that, I don't want to say playing with a lion's tail, but is that getting too dangerous here?
It's playing with fire. Nuclear fire. It's extraordinarily dangerous. Yes, but as I said before, the U.S.'s military record, as you point out, is extremely poor. The U.S. has lost every major war it's been involved in since World War II. And in that case, it was the Soviets who really won the war, not the Americans. But this is a war America has to win. If it loses, then not only America loses, but the American empire loses.
What would a win look like, though, for America? What would it look like?
Well, America wants to see, at the very least, see Russia expelled from all of the Ukraine, and probably the Crimea and the Donbass republics as well. It wants to see Russia make restitution. It wants to see Putin overthrown. It wants to see Russia itself shrunk and crippled. And it wants to see and wants to see China get down on its knees and apologize and to promise to be a good boy forevermore. But certainly the U.S. wants the invasion rolled back. And if it doesn't succeed in that, then the U.S. empire is in big trouble. So we are really facing an epic moment in global history where this amazing empire, which by the 1990s had virtually conquered the globe, is now facing a crucial test. A test it must and it must prevail. If it doesn't prevail, then the whole U.S. global order is going to be in big trouble.
Well, as our guest there, Daniel Lazar, mentioned Arnold August, and I heard him mention China on a number of occasions. That's the next stop for the U.S. I mean, if we're looking at what's happening in Ukraine, that could be a walk in the park compared to what we're going to see in China if the U.S. is going to pursue the same avenue. Or does that depend on the ticker on the stock market and to see how much money they've made, and maybe they say, okay, we've made enough money, so China is not going to be as severe? I mean, are we looking at U.S. really using the same approach towards China?
Well, I would go a bit farther and say that what the United States is doing in Russia, and let us make no mistake about it, their main goal in Russia is regime change in Moscow, to try to have a government there that is in favor or ready to ally with the United States. Now, not only China is the next step, but in my view, the attempt, the United American provocation, NATO provocation against Russia on its borders since 2014 is part of their overall goal, their main principal goal is opposing China. They want to see China weaken. They want to desperately try and keep China from increasing its economic influence, increasing even its moral influence, its example. Because after all, of course, Russia is not a socialist country, we agree. Okay, but China is. And it's quite well known amongst the world population, increasingly, especially in third world countries, that Russia has developed so much in terms of, for example, bringing millions of people, hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. Education is free there. Health is free there. They have advanced so much. And United States, that is what is threatening the United States. And I think it goes all the way back to Obama when he started that policy of the pivot against China. At least Obama foresaw that. He knew that China was coming. It was increasing its influence, economic, political, and moral influence in the world. And the United States should concentrate on China. And the conflict now in Russia, against Russia, is part of the overall main goal of the American pivot against China.
All right. And finally, Daniel Lazar, we're looking at the UK that's rationing cooking oil. We're looking at the IMF that sent out a warning saying in Africa there's going to be civil unrest, social disorder, because of what's happening with the food situation. We're looking at energy shortages around the world. The U.S. itself has recorded a 0.2% contraction, which many are saying signals a recession. And I could keep this going for another half hour probably, but we don't have the time. Is it worth it?
Well, I mean, first of all, the U.S. provoked this war, number one, which is extremely foolish from an imperial point of view. But the U.S. Just can't tolerate. It can't tolerate the Russian presence.
Right.
It can't tolerate having a rival, that challenges its global power. Therefore, the U.S. feels it is worth it, and is determined to pursue this war to the bitter end.
Thank you, Daniel. Sorry to jump in. Journalist and author Arnold August, thank you so much. Author and journalist from Montreal. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tachway, it's goodbye.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady. As always, it's my pleasure and absolute honor to be joined by my special guest and darling sister, Sister Razia Shamili. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, my dear sister Zainab.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Really
absolute
honored.
Pleasure. So on the previous episode, we were discussing the topic of cohabitation. We defined it as a couple, a man and a woman living with each other with no religious or legal contracts and bounds.
No formal contract.
Yes, no formal contract.
But there are some commitments between
yes,
the two.
Yes, there are some commitments, right? They're your person.
Yeah.
They're your significant other. They're your partner.
You divide the household chores. You communicate when you have problems. Mm-hmm. But then the concern and the issue is that all these compared with a married life, how much depth can you get out of these the elements that I just counted compared in a cohabitation and a married life?
Obviously, if we're looking at it from an Islamic perspective, cohabitation is not even a possibility for a man and a woman. I mean, if you're going to live together, go ahead and get married. If you're not married, you have no business living together.
Based on contracts and Islamic rules and Sharia, there is no place. Mm. But when you look at the reality of societies, this has become a trend. This has become a very popular issue. The next question is that, so what are the consequences of cohabitation on the society, on the individuals, on married life, on families? We said that there is better communication. There is more satisfactory communication in marriage. And we said why compared to cohabitation. And their spouses or partners' approach to parenting. Mm. This is another variable that in married couple, the partner's approach to parenting is more satisfactory in a marriage compared to cohabitation. Obviously, because you see yourself committed. And, you know, it's like it's your responsibility. You brought this child. Of course, in cohabitation, it's your biological child, too. But it's interesting, subhanAllah, that just the name or just the feeling or just the definition that you have of it in your mind makes an influence in the way
obviously
you treat your child.
Yeah, because it's a conscious decision. I don't think there was any time through history where human beings were ever negligent toward the importance of making conscious decisions in order to, number one, actualize a concept, and secondly, give it significance in terms of the rank in one's life. When you make a conscious decision to make this person your own and make yourself belong to this person and become one with them and reproduce and have a family and that conscious decision that was put into it
exactly.
and the active effort
exactly.
that you exert, well, that's going to make a whole world of difference. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Muslim Lady here on IRIB English Radio. We're going to be back after a short break. Stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters. This is Muslim Lady. And in the studio today, we've been talking about the hot topic of cohabitation, its definitions, its pros and cons, and where it is in terms of constructiveness for the well-being of the individual and the family as a whole in comparison, and the society in comparison to marriage.
Right. And we talked about when you undergo consciously, when you decide to undergo the contract of marriage, the formal contract of marriage, then you're more responsible, it seems, of parenting. And then as a woman, I'm just thinking that when you're cohabiting with someone, and then there's always the chance, in marriage, there's always the chance of getting divorced too. Mm. But then divorce is a big thing that happens. It just doesn't happen like that. But cohabitation, you can just...
Rather than your significant other walking off.
Exactly. Say, honey, you're very good. You're very cool. You're a respectful
person. But then, yeah, see, I understand what you said.
But then I'm going to say that there is still difference in my perspective.
Yeah, exactly. Because you said that God knows if deep down there isn't really a difference. There is.
There is difference.
Right. Because in the corrupt society, family means absolutely nothing. I'm not saying Western or Eastern. I'm saying a corrupt society where family means absolutely nothing. And one of the partners can just wake up one morning and walk out of the family. Who doesn't understand the sanctity of marriage does not receive its privileges either.
You're right.
Right?
Even though it's really much harder to get a divorce than to just walk out of someone's life. Mm. But then, as you said, there are a lot of irresponsible individuals who really don't care about the other person's feelings and, you know, like what the consequences of divorce. But I think still in comparison, divorce happens much harder than just walking out of someone's life.
Oh, yeah. It's
exactly. And the consequences of a divorce, it could be for several years that depression, your self-confidence that goes away,
the healing process
is a very long process. Whereas in the cohabitation, you actually don't, you every single day you tell yourself that this is a temporary relationship. It's not a marriage thing. He's not committed to me for life. Mm. You keep telling it to yourself. So once he walks out of your life, or once she walks out of his life, then the acceptance of the issue is, of course, easier. But I'm saying that in terms of the relationship between the couple, because a sexual relationship when a woman wants to get satisfied, it's a psychological thing rather than like a physical thing, you know? So like the satisfaction of a woman who knows that she's in a secure, supported relationship, that he is having her back all the time, and that he's by her side in difficult times and in ease, in good times and in bad times, then she has more peace of mind.
For sure.
She has more sense of security.
Security.
And the most important thing in a person's life is this feeling of security that from the first moment that we are brought to this life by our mother, the psychologists say that later on, all the complexities, all the
disorders
that happen to you is out of this one single root, this feeling of insecurity. Mm. Whether they don't show their love to you, whether they beat you up, or whether they don't even beat you up, but the way they look at you, the way they talk to you, the way they title you, right? Or when you're crying, you're very small, and soon mommy rushes to you and she holds you, she embraces you, and she shows her love to you. It might seem to be very trivial and not important, but that means building the sense of security in that child. Yep. And this goes on continues up until the time that you get married.
Yep,
right?
Yep, of course.
And I think a happy marriage is one where you have this feeling of security. Mm. And marriage, of course, is a bond. It's a relationship where you have, if it's a proper marriage, you know, based on the proper grounds and roots, then you would have more feeling of security.
Obviously, yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
And this verse in the Noble Quran where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, women are your garments and men are women's garments. So this libas thing, this garment thing is a protection. And we talked about it in one of our sessions.
Yep.
How, you know, the same way that clothes cover you and you know, make you feel good and secure in the hot weather, in the cold weather, or when you're going somewhere to a party where it's a very respected gathering and you want to wear something to like show that you're a respected person, your spouse is exactly the same. And this isn't anything more than this feeling of security.
For sure.
Feeling safe. Yep. And sound. Mm. And once you have this safe and sound feeling, then your contribution to the family will be so much more. Your contribution to the society, you as a daughter, mother, wife, father, and, you know, all the relationship that you have in the circle of your life, it will flourish just because you feel more secure.
Surely.
So the next point that we want to talk about is that, interestingly, married adults are also more likely than cohabitors to say that they feel closer to their spouses. SubhanAllah, this is amazing. Because, of course, the relationship looks exactly the same. Mm-hmm. You go out together, you eat together, you sleep together. You go to vacations together, you go shopping together, you do everything together. But then this feeling, I think it goes back again to the root of insecurity, that, oh, you, in the back of your mind, like, I might leave him, right? But then it's a defense mechanism that when you're in a cohabiting relationship, you try not to really get close to that person because you're scared of being heartbroken, mm-hmm. right? But in marriage, you lean on him. Mm. You say, oh, this is my guy. This is my husband, right? And I put my trust on him. Of course, if it's the right marriage. Not the marriages that you're just roommates under the same roof. But then your hearts are miles and miles away from one another.
True.
So this is another difference. And one more thing that I wanted to share with you was that most married and cohabiting adults cite love and companionship as the major reason why they decided to get married or move into together with their partner. The number one factor that joins or unites the two of you is love, right? But about 4 in 10 cohabitors also say finances, that's very interesting, and conveniences were important factors in their decision. So material standards or factors placed in a high position in the relationship of cohabitors. Whereas in according to statistics, finances and conveniences were not one of the top reasons that people decide to get married. Love and companionship is the major reason. It's the number one reason people decided to be together. This is just amazing. It just talks by itself.
Yep.
That I'm with you because my interest is with you. Mm. You pay part of my bills. You provide my sexual needs. You provide my emotional needs. Right? I'm sharing my room with you. I pay less rent. We go shopping. We split the cost of our grocery shopping. You know, there is material benefit for me. So this is heartbreaking. It brings insecurity in your life. This monetary factor is with you. You're going to be together. Then when things change, then this relationship is going to alter. It's going to be shift to another direction, right?
Right. That was interesting, and that was all the time that we have for today's episode. Thank you so very much for joining us. Until another salam, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty.
Who is the lover? Allah. Who is Ar-Rahman? Allah. Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He's the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah, Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men, and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
On Monday, the National Bureau of Statistics, ISTAT, announced Italy's employment rate reached almost 60% in March, with more than 23 million people in work. The figure is the highest since 2004, when the agency started to keep track of such records. This as the country's economy is emerging from the coronavirus pandemic amid serious concerns over increasing energy prices. Some trade unions have expressed skepticism about the way the data is gathered by the Bureau of Statistics.
The increase in the number of employed people should be evaluated with great caution, as in most cases it's temporary or petty jobs. Employment figures are made to look impressive, to show that the economy has picked up again, but the reality is very much different. Over time, insecure work has become prevalent in Italy, and workers are being blackmailed into accepting longer working hours and low wages.
Another point to consider is the definition of an employed person. For the majority of Western countries, statistical agency, working just 1 hour a week would be enough to be classified as an employed individual. Another report carried out by research institute Censis and trade union UGL shows that Italian salaries fell by over 8% in real terms between 2010 and 2020. The report has also highlighted the problem of in-work poverty in Italy.
Wages are really low, long working hours. It's difficult, very difficult.
Lo dico io personalmente perché...
Who better than me can tell you how hard it is to find a job? I've been looking for work for a year. The only time I found something, I was paid badly and off the books.
Over 13% of employed workers and almost 8% of the self-employed had earnings below the poverty line in 2020, up 3 percentage points compared to 2010. Italy is one of the few European countries without a minimum wage. A boom in temporary and on-call contracts in recent years and fragmentation in union representation have led to an increase in badly paid, undignifying jobs. Max Civili, Rome.
Israel and Saudi Arabia have no diplomatic relations, officially. But for years, extensive behind-the-scenes diplomatic and intelligence cooperation between Tel Aviv and Riyadh has been open secret. Now, it seems that curtains are falling off of the covert relationship. Israeli media have revealed that an Israeli aircraft landed in an airport in Saudi Arabia's capital, Riyadh, late on Monday. The private plane reportedly took off from Tel Aviv. But this is not the first time that this has happened. Last October, another Israeli private jet landed in Riyadh. making it the first time a public flight from Israel has ever landed in a kingdom. This is the latest among improving regional ties for Israel after agreements to normalize ties with four nations, namely the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan, were reached in the 2020 Abraham Accords. Tel Aviv and Riyadh opened their airspaces to each other in 2020. Apart from that, Israeli and Saudi officials have recently openly talked about normalizing ties. Last month, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman said Riyadh does not look at Israel as an enemy. He went on to describe Israel as a potential ally with many common interests. Saudi Foreign Minister Faisal bin Farhan al-Saud has also recently told a Hebrew language newspaper that the integration of Israel in the region will be a huge benefit not only for Israel, but for the entire region. Israeli President Isaac Herzog on Monday said in an interview that he likes to visit Saudi Arabia openly and called on Riyadh to join the Abraham Accords and normalize its ties with the regime. In November 2020, it was reported that the then Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had secretly visited Saudi Arabia. The warming up of ties comes amid the escalation of tensions in the occupied territories. Israel has increased its raids on Al-Aqsa Mosque in recent weeks and attacks Palestinian towns and cities almost every day. Palestinians have increased their operations in response to the crackdown. They have conducted several stabbing and shooting operations, including one in Tel Aviv in the past 2 months, leaving over a dozen Israelis dead. Palestinian response to the previous normalization deals has been clear, that it has not helped the resolution of the long-standing conflict in any meaningful way, and that Israeli brutalities, killings, house demolitions, land grabs and desecration of their sanctities have continued regardless. To them, resistance remains the only path leading to the liberation of the occupied territories.
Quran burnings have once again returned to Sweden as far-right Danish activist Rasmus Paludan desecrated the holy book outside Stockholm's central masjid on Sunday. Later that same day, he travelled to Uppsala and attempted to burn another, but local Muslims chased him off, one nearly being run over in the process. Paludan is a notorious leader of a far-right political party which stood in the last Danish elections, receiving just 1.8% of the vote, failing to win a seat. In 2020, he was jailed for racism and other offences. Throughout the month of Ramadan, Paludan has toured Sweden, burning Qurans in several Muslim-majority areas in various cities, sparking 4 days of violent unrest over the Easter weekend. Local Swedish opposition Nuance Party condemned the authorities for allowing the burnings.
Well, actually, in Sweden, you're not allowed to say or do whatever you want. So this concept of freedom of speech is already has its rules and its regulations. For example, 3 years ago, a neo-Nazi party burnt the Pride flag, the flag that the LGBT movement uses. And for that, they were charged for hate speech or hate against a certain people. Nowadays, the politicians, they don't account Muslims into these kind of minorities. On one hand, they're defending other minorities and their rights to be left alone or to not be hated against. And on the other hand, they are defending people who are hating it towards or against Muslims.
There's no word to describe our disappointment to the other political parties and the public figures that are defending him. We don't see any political parties that are going out and defending the Muslims and that are talking about issues that facing Muslims. So I think that is why this is happening.
Peace and tranquility has returned to Sweden, but tensions remain high as both local Muslims and the Swedish authorities know that the Quran burners will be back. Paludan has made absolutely clear that he intends to run in the Swedish elections this September, and it's very likely that he will bring further unrest back with him. Robert Carter, Stockholm.
International Workers' Day was celebrated in France with hundreds of marches nationwide as leftists of all sorts united to celebrate equality, solidarity, and worker empowerment.
The 1st of May is the International Day for workers to get together and discuss how to defend themselves. It's seemingly the only day where workers mobilise for their rights worldwide, and we see how there are so many countries represented here. Today is more important than any election or particular movement.
In 2020 and 2021, May Day was muted due to the coronavirus pandemic. The celebration is back to full strength this year, and many marchers have an added reason to be politically active. The recent re-election of Emmanuel Macron following a campaign dominated by the far right. Economic stagnation, record inflation, a bitter election campaign with results few are genuinely happy about. Many believe some changes are coming for France. The French left is in the middle of perhaps a major reconstitution. The communists, greens, and socialists are deciding whether or not to join forces behind Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who finished third in the presidential race. Should they unite for the June legislative elections, they could deny Macron absolute control of parliament and thus drastically change his plans for his second term.
I can't recall the last time people felt they were actually voting for someone rather than voting to eliminate something. But not everyone here accepts this logic of reformism. We workers who produce the wealth need to prove an alternative to this system, like the Yellow Vests do, through consciousness and organization.
Unions, notably quiet during the presidential campaign, were out in big numbers, though far from records. Police, normally elbow to elbow with protesters at Yellow Vest demonstrations, gave marchers plenty of room, with few serious confrontations reported. May Day 2019 is often considered the end of the major Yellow Vest demonstrations. Hundreds of arrests, warrantless searches starting from a 150-kilometer radius around Paris, and massive police violence gutted the average person's willingness to join 6 months of enormous anti-government protests. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
People in the Gaza Strip mark this year's Eid al-Fitr holiday for the 16th time under the Israeli blockade. The joyful occasion comes at the end of the holy month of Ramadan. Traditionally, Muslims go to markets several days before Eid to buy gifts, new clothes, and sweets for their loved ones, but many here can't afford that because of the high unemployment and poverty rates. United Nations figures show that 80% of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have been relying on handouts in recent years in order to survive.
I'm having a very hard time while trying to buy new clothes for the holiday. I'm on a very tight budget, and I really don't know how to get through this holiday. There is hardly any money in Gaza, and the situation is only getting worse day after day.
For Gazan families, it has been a very tough task to buy Eid items for their children amid the harsh economic situation in the besieged coastal enclave. People scour the markets for hours to try and find affordable gifts for their families.
Most Gazans are broke and can't buy Eid items for their families. Gifts and clothes are very expensive, but we're determined to celebrate this holiday. The Israeli blockade and the last wars will not steal our joy.
For merchants, this Eid season has been one of the worst they had in years. Usually during holidays like Eid al-Fitr, sales are high in markets around the world, but in Gaza, shop owners complain of lack of sales.
This has been the most difficult economic condition in over a decade, and people lack the purchasing power. Most people come to the market just to look around, and they hardly buy anything because the economic situation here is very bad. Things are tough, but the spirit of Eid al-Fitr is here, and people will try to make the best of it.
Despite the harsh circumstances, Palestinians in Gaza are preparing themselves to receive Eid al-Fitr holiday, like all Muslims around the world.
Eid celebrations in the besieged Gaza Strip will undoubtedly fall short of being full due to the ongoing Israeli blockade. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Russia
Russia's tensions with the West are threatening to quickly spiral out of control as the war in Ukraine drags on. Immediately after the start of the conflict on February 24th, the US and its allies rushed to the aid of Ukraine. They've imposed sweeping sanctions against Moscow and provided Kiev with military and humanitarian assistance. The size of those shipments and sophistications of the weaponry have been increasingly growing. Besides that, US State and Defense Secretaries recently traveled to Ukraine, promising more military aid.
They need long-range fires. You've heard them express a need for tanks. And we are doing everything that we can to get them the types of support, the types of artillery and munitions that will be effective in this stage of the fight. We're going to push as hard as we can, as quickly as we can, to get them what they need.
What I'm seeing, at least, is that aid is getting here and other distribution points. It's getting out the door incredibly quickly.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is the latest U.S. official to travel to Kiev. There, she promised Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky that more help is on the way. Pelosi was referring to a request by President Joe Biden from Congress to pass an aid package to Ukraine. The package is worth $33 billion, with almost two-thirds of it allocated to military aid. That aid includes everything from heavy artillery and armored vehicles to greater intelligence sharing, cyber warfare tools, as well as anti-tank and anti-aircraft missiles. Meanwhile, French President Emmanuel Macron, in a phone call with Zelensky, said Paris would step up military and humanitarian support to Ukraine. Those measures by the US and its allies have prompted strong warnings and criticism from Moscow. Russia says the military aid is not only fueling the conflict, but also boosting the risk of direct confrontation between Russia and NATO powers.
The tendency itself to pump weapons, including heavy weapons, to Ukraine and other countries is an action that threatens the security of the continent and provokes instability.
Yet more starkly, the Russian foreign minister has warned that the conflict in Ukraine risks escalating into a third world war. Sergei Lavrov says NATO is in essence engaged in a proxy war with Moscow by supplying Kiev with weapons. He has urged the US and NATO to stop sending weapons if they really want to resolve the Ukraine crisis. On the ground in Ukraine, Russia has been targeting foreign weapons. In the latest such move, Moscow says it struck weapons shipments supplied by the US and European countries on an airfield near the southern port city of Odessa. In another sign of escalation, Moscow says dialogue between Russia and the US on strategic stability has been formally frozen. And so as Russia's warnings go unheeded in the West, there's a real risk that the war will spill across Ukraine's borders before it comes to a peaceful resolution inside.
For the first time since the presidential election, the Yellow Vests marched around the country, and most expressed disbelief that Emmanuel Macron was re-elected despite his unprecedented repression of the group.
Frankly, we really don't understand how Macron could be re-elected. We started over purchasing power, and it's worse than ever. I guess people need a knife to their throats to come protest anymore?
They were met by a huge police presence, armed to the teeth. The government continues to intimidate Yellow Vests, but also the average person from rejoining the demonstrations. Intimidating deterrence is also being used to keep journalists from covering the group. In the Yellow Vest demonstration the day before the first round of voting, a journalist from a top French media was fined for allegedly illegally demonstrating while simply reporting on the Yellow Vests.
We'll never stop demanding for citizens' referendums, purchasing power, decent pensions, and the ability to have some money left at the end of the month. After the legislative elections in June and the summer vacation, social unrest will explode this fall.
Thousands of devoted Yellow Vests will continue to turn out every Saturday in Paris alone, and they say others will put their Yellow Vests back on when they see Macron's plans for his second term.
Emmanuel Macron will continue to be the president of the rich and will continue to march. People will eventually recover their good sense and realize the only way to change politics is to join us in the streets.
Nobody expected the Yellow Vests to stop marching, Now we'll see if they can last for the next 5 years.
Global May Day protests will see establishment forces, such as unions and political parties, march nationwide in favor of workers' rights, but also to express major dissatisfaction with the presidential election. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
As the month of Ramadan is coming to an end, Muslims are gearing up to pick the best clothes to get dressed up for one of their biggest festivities, Eid al-Fitr, or the Festival of Breakfast. This exhibition gives a glimpse of local costumes of several Muslim countries, from Tunisia and Egypt all the way to Afghanistan and Iran.
On Eid al-Fitr and other important festivities in Tunisia, men wear this white costume and women dress like me.